Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the purpose of a monument? People in centuries past didn't always agree on the form such commemorations should take, but few questioned the notion that these public displays would be expressions of glory and triumph. We created monuments to war heroes and victory and progress. But starting in the 20th century, artistic representations of collective memory also coalesced around the tragedies humankind had experienced: Pearl Harbor, the Holocaust, the Kennedy assassination, and 9/11. So how are these victim monuments different? How do they serve us? Where do they fail? And how do they impact our understanding of the sorrows that they represent? Kirk Savage is chair of the History of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh. His latest book is called Monument Wars: Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. He's in town to give a lecture this evening at the Sixth Floor Museum in downtown Dallas. Kirk, welcome to Think.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Why do we build monuments in this country?
Well, there are many, many, many different reasons, right? And those reasons have changed over time, as you mentioned in your opening. Traditionally, we erected monuments to the great white men that we revered as our national heroes and that we looked up to try to emulate. And so, you know, the landscape of the national capital is still full of these monuments, men on horseback and other forms like them, But as you say, you know, at a certain point in our history, and particularly in the late 19th, early 20th century, memorial spaces began to change, and the expectations around them began to change. And they began to change from objects that we revere to spaces that we experience, where we expect to kind of experience not only the triumphs of our history, but also the tragedies and traumas of our history. So places where people would go to try to sort of find what the nation meant to them, right? So that's, in the national case, that's really what, you know, where we have put our effort. You know, in the case in local, of course, there's a long history of commemoration at the local and state level for so many different reasons and purposes, which is also a fascinating subject in itself.
Well, one thing that seems to be common to a lot of monuments is the assumption that they represent closure. They either create closure or they represent the fact that we have come to a place where we understand what has taken place, and then we're able to decide what we think and put a monument up.
Right. I like to say that, you know, the traditional monument represents the last word on the subject. And, of course, that's a sort of impossible dream, right? I mean, anybody who thinks about it for even more than a minute realizes that the interpretation of these historical events or these historical figures changes greatly over time. The way we relate to them as citizens changes over time. As the world around us changes, we change our relationship to those events and those people. So the problem is that, you know, the public monument was always conceived of as a permanent kind of eternal form, right? And that's almost really the definition of the monument. They were to be built in permanent materials, marble, stone, bronze. They were supposed to last forever, be imperishable. And so they were supposed to, in a sense, sum up for all time the historical significance and of that person or that event. That is an idea that in many ways we still cling to that dream, I think. But there is also now a countervailing idea that monuments are supposed to be designed in such a way that they can evolve with us and change as we change. And so this has created a whole another set of expectations and also problems, I would say, with the public monument.
Do you think monuments really do influence the way we think about whatever it is they represent, or do they just force us to confront our own ideas about these things?
Well, I do think that they do both. I mean, certainly traditionally, you know, in the great era of the public monument of the 19th century, they were very much considered to be didactic, you know, pedagogical. We are going to teach, you know, people the great lesson of Washington's life, or, you know, so they were very much considered to be that way, though I think they often and usually failed to function that way, because people being human beings, you know, they go to these sites and they make of them what they will in their own way. And so, you know, that's the whole history of how the public has used, received, and interpreted these monuments is a fascinating subject in itself. And particularly in a place like Washington, because people from all over the country and all over the world go there for that reason, to see these kind of sacred spaces. And so one of the interesting things that's happened there is that these monuments have, in effect, been changed by the people who visit them and who use them. You know, have really, they have taken over these monuments in some cases. For example, the Lincoln Memorial is the great example of that, of a monument that was designed really during a period of Jim Crow and white supremacy in this country, and was then taken over really by the civil rights movement, and has now become a very, even though the physical form remains largely unchanged, the meaning of that monument has dramatically transformed over time.
Well, one thing that's been noted about the Lincoln Memorial, and you know, it's so iconic now that we don't think so much about what a groundbreaking thing it was in its time. It didn't look like anything else that had been been constructed before.
The Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, you know,
that's true. In many ways, I think you're right. I mean, first of all, in terms of the scale of the monument, if we think about the kinds of monuments that were being erected around the country and even in Washington, with one exception being the Washington Monument, the giant obelisk in the center. But typically, these were statues, you know, in traffic circles and public parks and public squares. So to have a large monument that was really a collection of spaces inside with different meanings. So there's a huge statue, but there are also, you know, to the side of the statue, there are these two separate rooms, each one of which has a full text of one of Lincoln's speeches. And that was really extraordinary. I mean, that still is actually pretty extraordinary, to have the full text rather than kind of cherry-picked, you know, inscriptions. So that it really was a place that invited people to come in and kind of experience the man and his legacy and the meaning of that era in a new way.
The other thing that's interesting, your most recent book is about the National Mall and the monuments that are there, is that they're not in a vacuum. They have to relate to one another, or they do relate to one another, whether or not there's a lot of consideration given to that.
That's right. And not only do they relate to one another, to what has come before them, so that, you know, the Korean War Memorial, for example, was erected largely because the Vietnam Veterans Memorial had been, and then the World War II Memorial erected in response to those events. And sometimes then those monuments are in dialogue with one another. The World War II Memorial, for example, is in many ways the antithesis of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. But the other interesting thing that happens, it's not only that they're relating, they're kind of jostling in a way with one another, but they also change the way that we see the monuments that came before them, which is something that is really interesting to me. I mean, for example, one example I like to use is the World War II Memorial. I think has really changed the way that I and other people experience the FDR Memorial, which covers a lot of the same territory, but in a very, very different way, with very different political messages. And so, you know, each new monument, in a sense, kind of revises the landscape that came before it and makes us see it in a fresh way.
How do we make decisions about the people and ideas and events that merit a monument?
Mm. Now, that is a great question. And the answer to that is complex and in many ways surprising. I mean, most people, when they think about, say, the public monuments in our nation's capital, they would think that they would assume that they were erected in some kind of coherent and regulated fashion. They aren't at all, okay? And they never have been. So in the 19th century, these monuments were generally proposed by private groups. They were sometimes funded by the government, but most of the time they weren't. Usually the money was raised by private associations. And those associations had to have political connections in order to get the authorization to be able to build these monuments on public land. But it was really very much a hodgepodge, you know, of different kinds of people and different sites. And there was a lot of criticism of that then in the early 20th century by planners and reformers around the country, but especially in Washington, who wanted to try to regularize this process and to try to figure out a way to kind of regulate both the subject matter of the monuments as well as their design and form. And since then, so there are now some regulatory agencies that have been for several decades in Washington that oversee the process. But in many ways, the process is still more like – the process of erecting a monument is still more like passing a piece of legislation in a way. It involves lobbying, political connections, and lots of factors that have really nothing to do with, say, the intrinsic merit of the project or the design merits of it.
Well, the design is an interesting element, too, because, you know, having now read some of your work and read up on the history of some of these things, so often they seem to be designed by committee or an artist proposes something and then everybody says, make this larger, make that smaller, take that away, move this here.
Yes, that's the case. That is definitely true. It's very much true of the World War II Memorial, for example, which started out, the architect Friedrich St. Florian started out with one design and then revised it. Endlessly in response to suggestions, pleas, you know, ultimatums from various committees that were involved in the process. A different kind of example is the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which the original memorial, Maya Lin's design, was not at all designed by a committee and was her vision. But one of the reasons that that succeeded was that she was such an extraordinary person who fought for her vision and fought really hard. She had to make a few compromises, but she fought really, really hard to retain that vision and was able to succeed, I think, ultimately in doing that, even though other elements to the memorial were added over her opposition, were added to the memorial. The original design still functions in something like the way she expected. But I would say that her experience is more the exception now, is more the exception to the rule. And it was because I think we were dealing with a really extraordinary person who was able to do that.
What's the difference in terms of the expectation that we bring to visiting a monument when it is dedicated to something that we are very proud of as opposed to something that we are ambivalent about or ashamed of?
Well, that, of course, was the case with the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which was, you know, as you know, politically very controversial. And so the sponsors of that monument deliberately, in the design competition, they deliberately specified that the monument design could not take any political stand for or against the war. So that, you know, the great kind of success of Maya Lin's design was that she was able to find a way to create a memorial that focused on only on the names of the dead in such a way that people of all political stripes and reactions to that event could have something in which they could share and come together around. So again, that's a fairly exceptional, you know, a fairly exceptional thing. So we have now, you know, typically. We don't typically erect monuments, and in our history haven't typically erected monuments to things that we are ashamed of. Slavery, for example, is something, you know, that's been largely absent from the memorial landscape.
Kirk Savage is my guest. He's chair of the History of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh. His latest book is called Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. He's in town to give a lecture tonight at the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Kirk Savage, who is chair of the History of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh. His latest book is called Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. You can hear his lecture tonight at the Sixth Floor Museum in downtown Dallas. You can find information about that at the Think page of KERA.org. If you would like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Before the break, Kirk, I know that the music sort of stopped you from making your final point. We had been talking about the unique nature of the Vietnam War Memorial.
Right, and the whole question of monuments to episodes in our history that we're not proud of. And so what I was leading up to there was an unusual monument that was erected in the year 2000 in Washington, which is a monument to the Japanese Americans who were interned during World War II. You know, many of these, as you probably know, were U.S. citizens who were forcibly removed from their homes and businesses and interned in camps in the western part of the United States. And so a reparations bill was passed for them in the 1980s. And as part of that process, a monument was erected, which eventually was completed in year 2000. And it has a pretty extraordinary inscription on it, which is from a speech by Ronald Reagan, where he said, "Here we admit a wrong." And that is very prominently displayed, that those words, "Here we admit a wrong," on the memorial. And it's, to my knowledge, it's the only place in the Capitol, in Washington, where there is an inscription that explicitly acknowledges culpability of the government or the American people for a kind of historical crime. But it's done in the context of this very beautiful, kind of restful, you know, Japanese kind of garden monument, which is also at the same time a memorial to the young Japanese American men who fought for the U.S. in the World War II, some of whose parents were actually interned in the camps that are also commemorated there.
It is really extraordinary, given the long history of African-American presence in this country, that there was not an African-American depicted in a monument until 1876.
That's right. And that lone figure was the only figure for until essentially the Civil Rights era, so for 100 years. That's the figure of a crouching slave in the memorial to Abraham Lincoln in Lincoln Park, about a mile east of the Capitol. Building. Yes, and that just really speaks to the whole neglect or, you know, deliberate omission of the entire subject of slavery in most of the official public landscape of the Capitol and the memorial landscape really across the country in a much broader way. And, of course, you know, that there's an attempt to kind of rectify that now in the new Capitol Visitor Center, the Visitor Center to the new U.S. Capitol, there's a giant Emancipation Hall, for example, where this issue is addressed. But the Capitol building was designed specifically. You know, there were actually suggestions to put figures of slaves, you know, in various places in the decoration of the Capitol, and they were, you know, beaten back in the 19th century. So it's a giant historical omission that's really, I think, only going to be ultimately really truly rectified when the National Museum of African American History and Culture is completed, you know, which will be probably many years in the future on the Mall.
And I guess the story of that particular monument was that it was built with the money of African Americans,
yes,
but they didn't get any say in the actual design.
That's right. And so, you know, again, this is this monument, and it's the so-called Freedmen's Memorial to Abraham Lincoln. So it is supposedly their project. They paid for it. Most of the money came from African American soldiers who fought for the Union during the Civil War. But they had no presence or authority whatsoever in the public sphere at that time. They had no ability to – they weren't on the committees that chose the artist or the design. They had really no way to influence the outcome of that monument. And I like to compare it to, for example, there's a monument that was erected to an Irish naval hero by the name of John Barry that was sponsored by Irish American organizations. And it was the exact reverse of the Freedmen's Memorial process, where not only ended up having complete control of the design process, they actually fired the original sculptor of the monument and changed the design history of that monument. But then they didn't have to pay for it. They got the government to pay for it. So it really is a testament to the real disempowerment of the African American community, you know, in the public sphere in the United States in the 19th century. And it wasn't until the Civil Rights Movement that that would change.
A lot of people were hoping that President Obama would break with tradition on Memorial Day and not send a wreath to the Confederate portion of Arlington National Cemetery. Why do you think he chose not to? Not to break with tradition and to send a wreath?
Well, this is an interesting story, and actually I got involved in this story.
I know.
Because I was asked actually by a guy, you know, by an academic here from Texas to sign a petition to urge Obama not to send the wreath to the Confederate Memorial in Arlington. And I really didn't think that that was – first of all, I thought that was politically just impossible for him to do. But secondly, you know, the problem with that idea is that there are many people who are descendants of Confederate veterans who don't, I'm a descendant, for example, of Confederate veterans. I completely disown the ideology of the Confederacy, and I think it's repugnant. But, this memorial is located in a section of the cemetery where Confederate men are actually buried. And these are ordinary soldiers, and a lot of them weren't particularly fighting for slavery, though the Confederacy was dedicated to preserving that institution. The ordinary men on the ground who fought for it had, as in every war, had every possible reason for being there, including the fact that they were drafted. So not sending a wreath would have sent a kind of message, would have been interpreted as a message of dishonoring those soldiers who were buried there. So actually, I mean, I wrote an op-ed piece in the Washington Post, and my idea was to send a second wreath, not to stop sending the wreath to the Confederate Memorial, but to send another wreath to the African-American Civil War Memorial in Washington, which is a memorial that's dedicated to the 200,000 African-American men who fought for the Union and whose history had been largely for almost 100 years, their history had been completely erased, you know, from American consciousness. From mainstream American consciousness. So I suggested that this would be a different way of doing it. Rather than trying to avoid the controversy at Arlington, why not change the ritual and send a second wreath and then make us think about the relationship of the Confederacy to slavery by doing that.
And is that what happened?
That is what happened, actually. Amazingly, I never heard from the White House, but that morning, Memorial Day morning, a car, I heard from the people at the memorial, a big black, car pulled up and a wreath came out from the White House and was put at the memorial. So,
Kirk Savage is my guest. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to David in Plano. Hi, David.
Hi, Chris. Great show, again, as always.
Thank you.
I have a question for the guest. I know it's maybe a little early to be thinking about this, but it never hurts to at least ask an expert about it. But we've had two wars in the Persian Gulf now, and I haven't heard anything about a monument or a museum or anything like that related to the first Gulf War. And the second Gulf War is going to be wrapping up pretty soon, from what we can tell, hopefully. So I'm curious to know if the guest has heard anything about any organizations working on that and what you think we might expect when it comes to the type of memorial we might see if one comes about, 8-10 years from now.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm sorry that I don't have any inside information for you about that. I too have heard rumblings of ideas and proposals. But I don't have any. I don't know of anything specific that has gotten organized yet, organized enough to make a real concrete project. That kind of thing. That's going to have a long and difficult road ahead of it. Any monument now that is erected in Washington has to go through a lot of both legislative and regulatory hurdles before it is completed, and. Also, you may know, or may not know, that the the National Capital Planning Commission and Congress now have designated the kind of core area of the mall as a reserve zone where they don't want any more monuments to be built. They've decided they're calling it a completed work of civic art. So that is also an issue. If they hold on to that, which is a big if they hold on to that, where would such a monument be located? There are other monuments where this issue is addressed. You know, for example, at the Marine Corps War Memorial, so-called Iwo Jima Memorial, that memorial is constantly updated. You know, with whatever new conflicts the Marines have been involved in, and so the first Persian Gulf War does appear there as an inscription. You know, just as a name on the monument.
Talk about the plans for Ground Zero and what's been taking place there, because the point has been made that we are still very much unpacking how we feel about what came after 9/11. And right. That's got to play into our interpretation of what happened on that day and what's happened since.
Right. It's an excellent question. It's a very, very difficult subject. At Ground Zero now, it is the memorial enterprise has really been split into two. There is a memorial proper, which will list the names of the dead, and in the footprints of the World Trade Center. And then there is also a memorial museum, which is underway. And both of these are actually under construction now. So the memorial proper is a kind of fixed form, you know, sort of conceived of in your traditional kind of sense of a closed monument that's going to remain fixed forever, but just focuses on the names of the dead in a landscape kind of setting below ground. The museum is a different kettle of fish, right? And that's that is meant to be, again, one of these projects in which the people behind the project, the designers of the project, are trying to present it as an evolving institution. They understand, obviously, probably, you know, every month, every year that goes by, our feelings and our understanding of that event change as the world changes and as, you know, events in the Middle East and as our wars drag on, as all that happens. So they're trying to design the museum space to be a place that can, in fact, be both authoritative but also evolving, which I think is rather paradoxical. But that's the kind of circle that they're trying to square there. Yeah.
Recognizing that, you know, we often never finish evolving our ideas about things in our history, whether they are good or bad, is there sort of an amount of time that ideally should pass between an event and the decision to commemorate it with a memorial or a monument?
You know, I don't really think so. People often ask this question, or people often talk about this and note that in some cases, you know, maybe decades go by before a monument is erected. But, you know, whether a monument is erected a year later or 10 years later or 100 years later, you know, the same issue arises, which is that whatever point, there is never a point at which you're going to find the answer, what this event is going to mean to us, mean to the country for the rest of our national life. That process of evolution is going to continue. So whether it happens in the distant future or the not distant future, as long as we have a chance to revise what we've done, either we build, in the case of Washington, the Freedmen's Memorial was erected in 1876, which was 11 years after his assassination. But, you know, there were other monuments to Lincoln, and the Lincoln Memorial that we all know now wasn't erected until 1922. So that process the other thing is that the process can't be stopped. You know, if you erect a monument 10 years later and there's still a need for people, you know, to remember that event, they're likely to either change what's been done or erect something new, you know. So,
Kirk Savage is my guest. His latest book is called Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. We have an email here from John in Dallas who writes, I find it interesting that Dealey Plaza has now become associated with John Kennedy rather than the newspaperman honored in the late 30s by construction of the monument. Mm-hmm. Sometimes places take on a history of their own.
Yeah, definitely. And that whole issue of the naming of places is really, really interesting. And one of the things that that question points to is the way in which names and even monuments change in significance over time and sometimes grow completely obsolete so that the original name that's commemorated there may be lost to most people's memory and have no connection left with it at all. And that happens in a place like Washington all the time as well. Most of these traffic circles were named after the statues that were located there, and now, you know, nobody knows who General Thomas is or McPherson. I mean, I do, but most people. But that's only because I've studied the subject. That's a very good example of something that's happening all the time.
What do you think about the Kennedy Memorial in downtown Dallas? A lot of people have criticized it as being ultimately sort of ineffective, and what has become the de facto Kennedy Memorial is that square around the plaza.
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, I don't know the sites very well at all. So one of the things I'm going to do this afternoon is look at them much more carefully. The Kennedy Memorial that you're talking about is the Philip Johnson Memorial?
Yes.
To me, that's a very sterile site, and it's a work of high modernism. And this was a time in which it was very, very difficult for architects at that period of time working in that vocabulary to erect public monuments, because modernism, one of the most famous quotes here, you know, from a modernist is, there is no such thing as a modern monument. If it's modern, it's not a monument. If it's a monument, it's not modern.
You've got time, 30 seconds.
So this is a problem that I think Philip Johnson really had, and it's a problem that we've seen, you know, for example, the original FDR memorial design was very similar and was eventually scotched for that reason. But how to create a space like that that's commemorative? A space in modernism doesn't generally have content. How do you create content in a space like that? It's difficult.
Kirk Savage is my guest. His newest book is called Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. He will be giving a lecture tonight at the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas. You can join the conversation now by calling 1-800-933-5372 or sending an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, who can help you get ahead in today's tough economy. Hundreds of courses begin weekly this fall. Online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Chair of the History of Art and Architecture at the University of Pittsburgh, Kirk Savage. His latest book is called Monument Wars, and he's in town to give a lecture this evening at the Sixth Floor Museum in downtown Dallas. If you want to join us, send an email to think@kera.org or call us at 1-800-933-5372. Kirk, will we now, after decades of making a lot of monuments to things that maybe should have been memorialized before but weren't, but we do have a lot of these what you call victim monuments, does that preclude a return to something glorious that is sort of unabashedly proud of elements of our history?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm really not sure where we're headed, actually. The World War II Memorial is a monument that is unabashedly triumphal. Mm-hmm. World War II, of course, you know, is a story that everyone can get behind. You know, it is the just war of all just wars and the Greatest Generation, and all those things are true. And so we've been able to kind of coalesce behind that idea. But even at the World War II Memorial, as I kind of argue in my book, there is a kind of nostalgic feel about this monument of a time when the United States had a kind of undisputed and simpler kind of global supremacy. And in a lot of ways, that monument, I think, is going to look, as we get further and further from it, it's going to look more and more like a monument of the era of the war on terrorism and a kind of nostalgic back look back to a day when terrorism didn't exist, or when, you know, war was between states rather than shadowy enemies that we couldn't put our finger on. So even the triumphalism of the World War II Memorial, I think, is a little bit bittersweet at this point. And it's hard to see where – it is a little hard to see where we're moving from here, you know, with, for example, the commemoration of 9/11, September 11th, and what that's going to look like. I think it's very hard to know.
We have an email here from Mark in Richardson, who wants to know if you would comment on the nature of the Oklahoma City bombing memorial as it appears to honor the victims of its tragedy in a relatively unique way. Mark says, as an Oklahoman myself, this memorial is deeply important to me, and I feel as though it does a marvelous job of paying tribute to the many victims of the event. Are you familiar?
Yes, I am familiar with that memorial. And I think that's a very interesting space. And an interesting project, and I've actually, you know, I have thought about it at some length, but I have mixed feelings about that project. And while I think that it has done, in many ways, a really wonderful job of honoring the people who died on the site, it's also had a very difficult time, it seems to me, dealing with the nature of that event and the perpetrator of that event. And that was a very difficult thing for the people involved in the monument, to deal with the perpetrator, you know, Timothy McVeigh and what he stood for, and the kind of militia movement out of which he came, and that homegrown terrorism. All that sort of stuff was, I think, difficult for them to take on. There's another issue to me which is interesting about that monument, which is that each victim has a bronze chair. In a rather large space. I mean, I think it's 13 acres or something like that is what the total site is. So it's a very large scale monument, and I think a good use of that space. But it's a kind of solution. It's interesting because it's a solution that couldn't work in other cases when the number of victims is much higher. They can't. So, you know, one of the things that I'm interested in is how these design solutions grapple with, you know, as the number of victims mounts in whatever tragedy is that's commemorated, how are those? Can we even then mark individuals? How do we do that? You know, at the Holocaust Museum, which is 6 million, obviously we can't have 6 million chairs or anything like that. So we can't even have 6 million names, or we don't even know all the names of the dead. And so there are different solutions to that issue and to that problem. But it draws attention to that and the scale of the tragedy and how that scale is dealt with in the design.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go next on the phone to Keith in the Colony. Hey, Keith.
Hi. I have a quick question for Kurt. I have been to Oklahoma City, but I'll never forget the first time I saw Mount Rushmore when I was a kid. And are you aware of any big monuments that are going on outside of Washington in the West or in the rest of the United States? I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call.
Well, you know, there's that ongoing project similar to Mount Rushmore to the Crazy Horse Monument, also in South Dakota, which I haven't checked on it in a few years, but it's I think, still ongoing. Huge, and very interesting project. But in a way, I think, you know, the Mount Rushmore is going to be will never again. Never again are we going to be allowed to dynamite a granite mountain face to do that. And in some ways, you know, I feel a little bit bittersweet even about that. You know, the whole project is so fantastic and so unbelievable in its scale and in its ambitions. But, you know, again, never again will we be able to do anything quite like that, for so many reasons, partly because we've lost to some extent lost our belief in that heroic landscape, partly because, you know, there are environmental reasons for not doing it and many, many, many other reasons.
What, in your mind, differentiates a monument that really works from one that somehow misses the mark?
That is a very good and very difficult question, because let's take the example of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, which is so beautiful and does hit the mark in so well in so many ways. You know, nobody predicted that solution. Nobody predicted that kind of design. It's only since it's been made that we can point to it as such an ideal kind of solution to the whole problem of commemorating the war dead. And so there are, you know, there are 1,000 different ways to do it. And one of the – this may sound like an evasion of the question, but one of the things I'm actually interested in is trying to create a space in which impermanent memorials can be erected. In other words, ephemeral monuments, or monuments that are not made to last forever.
Like the AIDS quilt?
Things like that, right, or projections on buildings, and counter monuments, various kinds of installations that have been done, because they open up a lot of field of possibilities to us that we don't have. You know, that's what artists do, right? They create new ways of envisioning, new solutions and new ways of envisioning things that we don't know about. So if I had to sit down and write a set of criteria for you about what constituted, you know, the kind of correct or incorrect or good or bad public monument, I think I would be dissatisfied with whatever set of criteria that I came up with, and I would feel like it probably created a straitjacket for any, you know, great artist, somebody like Maya Lin, you know, would create a straitjacket for somebody that would probably prevent, you know, kind of interesting, ingenious new ideas from arising.
Well, what's interesting about that assertion is that it sort of reflects the amount of arguing that we tend to do. No matter how much we agree that something ought to be memorialized, we never can agree on exactly what form something should take.
Absolutely. And so, you know, let's take, for example, the 9/11 memorial. You know, if I had been, and I, you know, I know people who are on that jury. Well, if you're put on the jury of something like that, then you kind of have to come up with some kind of criteria of your own. But the criteria that they came up with, you know, they said, well, we don't want it to be iconic. We want it to be evolving. We don't want it to be a simple kind of representation. We want it to admit of complexity of interpretation and evolving interpretation. And those criteria all make sense. But at the same time, you know, I'm not so sure that even those criteria are hard and fast. You know, that maybe we can come up with something iconic that would work, for example. And by iconic, I mean something like Mount Rushmore. You know, I mean to put it in the most simple terms.
Let's go back to the phones now. Next on the line, we have Frank in Denton. Hello, Frank.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love the show today. I was interested in your guest talking about the Kennedy Memorial, how Philip Johnson, using the architect of vocabulary of modernism, wasn't quite able to pull something off there. And I'm thinking of Maya Lin's Vietnam Memorial or something as different as the Pearl Harbor Memorial,
right?
Which kind of get their power, one, from a sense of place, that's where it happened, and two, Maya Lin's memorial, I'm sorry, has always left me cold, except for the interaction of the families leaving gifts and taking the etchings and leaving the flags. And them just touching the memorial. And I'm just wondering if you might contrast those memorials. Again, I have some heartburn with the new World Trade Center memorial, and it leaves me cold. And I'm just wondering what, if any, solution there might be. There's some modern memorials out there that work, those two in particular. And this one, it's not grabbing me. I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about it, please.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks.
Right. Well, I think, you know, you're absolutely right to point out that Maya Lin's monument is in a sense a work of high modernism, a minimalism, we might call it. But it is really rich in the sense that it's, you know, this black granite surface that reflects the world around it. So you see yourself in it. So it's actually full of imagery in a way. It's ephemeral, passing imagery, which interacts with the names. And so it becomes it's very different from the Philip Johnson, which is a much more static kind of form, modernist form. So, you know, I think that's a distinction that to be made. The way in which, yes, it the Vietnam Veterans Memorial not only reflects the world around it, but then actually encourages and prompts people to interact with it, and that becomes then it's less an object, and it becomes a space of experience and a space of interaction. And it's really what happens in that space that is actually the monument, is what is happening in that space. So in the case of the 9/11, you know, the World Trade Center Memorial that you brought up, I tend to agree with you that I think it could be a very sterile – it has the potential to be a very sterile experience. But until it's actually built and we go there and we see it and we start interacting with it, we really won't know until we can see how that space works.
You know, Frank's point that what he finds moving about the Vietnam Memorial is the interaction of people that go. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have shared that, and you never go see that where there aren't people interacting with the wall who have a direct connection. What's sort of, you know, eerie about the future is that at some point, decades from now, there won't be people who feel a direct connection to the monument. Does it lose its effectiveness?
Yes, and it's a great point, a great question. And I think the answer is yes, it does. I mean, we have beautiful examples in Washington. There's a beautiful World War I memorial to the residents of Washington, D.C. that served and died in World War I. It's a kind of temple-like form that is totally ignored and forgotten today, and it's in great need of preservation because the World War I generation has died out, and even the kin networks that belong to that generation have kind of evaporated in many ways. That is already actually happening at the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. It's a very different experience now from when I first went. You know, when I went to that monument when it first opened, where it seemed that everybody was there had some kind of really direct personal connection. You know, so they knew somebody up on that wall, and it was a very visceral experience being there. And it's different now. And the sponsors of the memorial, who, you know, are still around, this is one of the reasons that they have gotten authorized, one of the reasons why they argued that they needed a visitor center, an underground visitor center, because people coming to the monument now don't have that connection with it, don't even know where Vietnam is on a map. And so they need to, now they feel like they need to provide context. They need to, and this is the story that you see for public monuments all the time everywhere, is that gradually they fade into oblivion, right? And they become obsolete with a few really strong exceptions like the Lincoln Memorial. But this tends to be the rule, and the other ones tend to be the exceptions. And that's one of the great ironies of the public monument. They were erected to be permanent, you know, and eternal, but really they depend on an audience, you know, and that audience, as the event recedes into the past, as the generation that created it and that it was really meaningful for, as they die off, the monument dies off as well.
Is that okay, or should we find ways to sort of revitalize the monuments that don't feel relevant to us anymore?
Yeah, I absolutely think we should. I mean, I think that we should be actively involved in reinterpreting these sites and reinterpreting these monuments and making them come alive again, because they are, not only are they about our history, but they are products of certain historical moments, and we can learn a lot from them, I think, and we can engage with them in really interesting ways. This is one of the things that frustrates me about the memorial landscape, is that it's treated in such a kind of kid glove way. You know, we're not allowed to, touch them in so many ways. And so it's really a kind of passion of mine to get people to think about how to bring these monuments into the 21st century.
Kirk Savage's latest book is called Monument Wars, Washington, D.C., the National Mall, and the Transformation of the Memorial Landscape. His 5:30 lecture at the Sixth Floor Museum is co-sponsored by SMU's Human Rights Holocaust Legacy Series in the Department of Art History. Kirk, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and thanks for the questions, which were terrific. I appreciate everybody calling in.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.